Chapter 5. Testing Scam. In a series of recent articles published in local and national news media, as well as in various scientific papers, some of the world's leading medical doctors and immunologists have made surprisingly honest, and shocking, statements about coronavirus testing. The test used is called a PCR test. PCR means polymerase chain reaction. Here are some samples of these statements. We did not perform tests for detecting infectious virus in the blood. This statement came from a paper in which the authors alleged they had discovered the novel coronavirus in patients suffering from COVID-19. There is no way to tell whether the RNA being used in the new coronavirus PCR test is found in these particles seen under the electron microscope. There is no connection between the test and the particles, and no proof that the particles are viral. Ironically, this statement does not come from a paper attempting to debunk the coronavirus causation of COVID-19. It comes from a paper that adamantly espouses this connection, but which claims that more research is needed to understand the interesting intricacies of this new virus. Or this, from the head of the Marin County Public Health Department, charged with making public health policy for Marin County, California. The PCR tests means you either are infected with the novel coronavirus or you are not infected with the virus. Such a statement is akin to going to the refrigerator store to purchase a new refrigerator and asking the salesman about a new model in the showroom. He says to you, "It's a new and interesting model, it will either keep the food cool or it won't." Most people would not choose to elevate this person to head of refrigeration for Marin County. An NBC News feed reported on certain puzzling results. Sailors who test positive, then negative, then positive for COVID-19 using the PCR test. This should not happen if the test is any good. A CDC representative stated, "Detection of viral RNA does not necessarily mean that infectious virus is present." According to one infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, it's possible that people could shed remnants of the virus for some period of time. That doesn't mean anything is wrong with them or that they are contagious. These statements are all referring to the test used to claim that a person is infected and can spread the disease. When asked about these statements, the head of a lab that specializes in testing for infectious disease told us, "A positive PCR test means you have active disease or you are a carrier and don't have active disease." When we asked how to distinguish between those who have active disease and those who are carriers, she confidently replied, "Those with active disease are sick, the carriers are well." Then we asked how one knows whether sickness is caused by the virus, since the test can be positive whether or not you are sick. She replied, "You can do a PCR test and find out whether the sick person has the virus." Welcome to the Alice in Wonderland world of virology. Finally, the most revealing quote of all, this one from the chief of infectious diseases at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. "We just don't have enough details yet to make confident statements about immunology." This quote is by an immunologist, and immunologists are the ones deciding public policy. They have put the world under house arrest. It would be nice if they could at least confidently say they knew something about immunology. How did this shocking situation concerning tests for viral diseases come about? Let's return to the story of Stefan Lonka, PhD, a virologist from Germany, whom we discussed in Chapter 3. Lonka's work has helped cut through the veils behind which the field of virology is shrouded. As a young graduate student in Germany, Lonka made the chance discovery of the first virus in seawater. Using electron microscopy in his studies of sea algae, he noticed that the algae contained particles. To find out what these particles were, and knowing that no one had described viruses living within healthy algae before, he proceeded as follows. He ground up the algae in a sort of blender, essentially to break apart the walls of the algae. Then he purified this mixture using an extremely fine filter to separate out particles the size of viruses from everything else. In this way, he obtained a pure solution of water and viruses and anything else that is the size of a virus or smaller. Then he put this mixture into a density gradient centrifuge, which spins the solution and allows the particles to separate out into bands. The final step uses a micropipette to suck out the band that contains only the virus. This simple procedure is the gold standard for the purification and isolation of a virus from any tissue or solution. It's not an easy process, but it is not unduly difficult either. He could then study this purified virus under an electron microscope, elucidate its shape and structure, analyze the genome, and ascertain which proteins it contained. With this work, he could confidently state he had discovered a new virus and was sure of its makeup. For this discovery, he received his doctorate and was about to embark on a promising career as a virologist. The only part of Lenka's experiment that surprised him was that in studying the interaction of algae with this new virus, he was forced to come to the conclusion that algae containing the virus were thriving and were much healthier than the algae without the virus, which were barely surviving. He may have been the first to come to the conclusion that real viruses in the bodies of other species are not pathogens, as was thought at the time, but rather are integral to the healthy functioning of the host. In essence, he was one of the first to propose that in addition to having a microbiome inside us, we also have a virome, and without this virome, we cannot be healthy. This was a radical concept in the 1980s, as no one else had proposed such a theory. If we compare the simple, logical, straightforward way in which Lenka isolated, purified, and characterized his virus, with the description of how modern virologists propagate viruses now, one begins to see the problem and confusion around testing for viral diseases. When Lenka realized that workers in the field of modern virology were never isolating, purifying, or properly characterizing viruses, but instead confusing what they were finding with artifacts made by their propagation techniques, he naturally questioned whether the viruses that supposedly were causing disease even existed. His question was not so much about whether viruses are infectious entities, but something even more fundamental, whether these viruses even exist at all. Compare Lenka's careful work with how current virologists find and characterize viruses, including the novel coronavirus. They start with sputum from a sick person, having no idea how this person got sick. They centrifuge but do not filter the sputum. This is not a purification process, as they readily admit in all of the papers written about the coronavirus. Here's what the authors of the original papers that found and linked the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 to the disease now called COVID have to say. The following quotations come from the brilliant paper, COVID PCR Tests Are Scientifically Meaningless, by Torsten Engelbrecht and Konstantin Demeter. Referring to a published image in a paper claiming to have isolated a new virus, they say, the image is the virus budding from an infected cell. It is not purified virus. If it's not purified virus, how do the authors know whether or not it is even a virus, what it is, or where it came from? In the paper, Identification of Coronavirus Isolated from a Patient in Korea with COVID, the authors stated, "We could not estimate the degree of purification because we do not purify and concentrate the virus cultured in cells." In other words, they did not isolate the virus, even though they claimed to do so in the title. In the article, Virus Isolated from the First Patient with SARS-CoV-2 in Korea, the authors admitted, "We did not obtain an electron micrograph showing the degree of purification." In other words, the authors have no idea whether or not the sample is purified, as an electron micrograph is the only way to determine that. They then claim to have characterized the genetic material of something they never purified, having no idea what they were looking at. This was an important study, as it describes the first case of COVID in Korea. Finally, the article, A Novel Coronavirus from Patients with Pneumonia in China, states, "We show an image of sedimented virus particles, not purified ones. The researchers took nasal mucus, snot, from sick people, centrifuged it, which is not a purification step, and then showed a fuzzy picture of what they found. Then they carried out a genetic analysis of this sediment in order to characterize the novel coronavirus." This piece of fraud was published in the esteemed New England Journal of Medicine. What is in the centrifuged material that these papers describe? The centrifuged material contains bacteria and perhaps viruses, fungi, human cells, cell debris, and anything else found in the lungs or sinus passages of a sick person. Researchers then inoculate this unpurified mess onto living tissue to make it grow. Sometimes this tissue is lung cancer tissue, sometimes aborted fetal tissue, and sometimes tissue from monkey kidneys. In any case, it is a complex mixture of many components, known and unknown. And then because this virulent, infectious virus won't infect and kill this living tissue unless you starve and poison the tissue first, you deprive the tissue of nutrients and add oxidizing agents to weaken the tissue. Then you add antibiotics to make sure it's not bacteria that is killing the tissue. The tissue from this treatment naturally disintegrates into thousands of components. Then you centrifuge this mess again to find your virus. At that point, you start the PCR testing to determine the genetic and protein makeup of this virus. The problem is that, unlike the clear situation that Lanka encountered in this slapdash way, you never have the isolated intact virus as a reference to allow you to know which genetic parts of your unpurified mess actually belong to the virus you are trying to characterize. As mentioned in Chapter 3, after studying the way in which virologists said they had found the measles virus, without isolating and purifying it, and actually deciding on the genetic makeup by consensus, Lanka offered a prize of €100,000 to anyone who could demonstrate its existence. In the first court to hear the proceedings, the claimant for the prize won the case, the judge concluding that proof of the measles virus did indeed exist. However, the German Supreme Court, with its more stringent rules of evidence and the appointment of a science master to oversee the case, ruled that the claimant, in fact, did not prove the existence of the measles virus. Lanka did not have to pay the claim. How is Lanka's work relevant to the current test used to detect the presence of viruses, specifically for the coronavirus? Clearly, if one can't prove that the coronavirus even exists and that the testing for this imaginary virus is bogus, then the world has been led wildly astray. If the test for the coronavirus is inaccurate and misleading, as is the case, then there are no grounds for believing the reports about the number of COVID cases, the number of COVID deaths, or any other statistics coming from the orthodox medical institutions. If the testing is bogus, then the coronavirus emperor has no clothes. Let's contrast Lanka's elegant experiments with the testing procedures used to determine the alleged presence of coronavirus infection. The first thing we need to understand about a PCR, polymerase chain reaction, test is that it is a surrogate test. It does not find a virus. Rather, it finds something else said to indicate the presence of the virus. A surrogate test is one that is generally easier and less expensive to perform and can stand in for the gold standard test of actually finding the virus and thereby make the clinical practice of medicine easier, safer, and cheaper. For example, pulmonary emboli result from blood clots that travel to the lungs. Symptoms include chest pain and shortness of breath. Pulmonary emboli can be fatal. It is important to diagnose the condition early, as it can be treated with blood thinners. It is also important to diagnose accurately, as pulmonary emboli share many symptoms with heart attacks and pneumonia, which call for different kinds of treatment. Fortunately, there is a test that is 100% reliable for finding pulmonary emboli when performed properly. The procedure, called an angiogram, involves inserting a catheter into the arteries of the lungs. Then the radiologist injects dye into the artery. The dye contains heavy metals that one can see on an X-ray. If a clot is present, the angiogram reliably and accurately demonstrates its presence to the radiologist on the real-time X-ray. With this test, referred to as the gold standard, one can confidently say whether or not the patient has an embolus. Angiography, however, is technically challenging. It is difficult to find the artery with the catheter. It is costly, due to the time and equipment needed. It is dangerous, as the artery may tear during insertion of the catheter. Another problem with angiography is that it requires injecting heavy metals into the artery and subjecting the patient to a lot of radiation. Consequently, medicine has looked for a surrogate test that can more easily and safely detect pulmonary emboli. The VQ scan looks at the blood flow into and through the lungs and compares this with the air movement into and through the lungs. When all is well with the lungs, these two parameters match up. When an embolus is present, they usually don't match up because blood flow is compromised. This allows the diagnostician to surmise that even though they have not actually seen a clot, it is likely to be present. A surrogate test is one that does not look for what you need to find but rather for something likely to be there if the condition is present. The surrogate test allows doctors to make an educated guess. To validate a surrogate test, one must first do a careful study in which the surrogate test is compared to the gold standard test. This gives you exact information as to how accurate you can expect the surrogate testing to be. These validating studies are usually carried out at a large medical center or a group of medical centers. The researchers begin by finding a large number of patients, say 2,000, with symptoms typical of pulmonary emboli. For simplicity's sake, Let's say that 1,000 do have an embolus as demonstrated with an angiogram, the gold standard test, whereas the other 1,000 do not. Now, we have a group of people who either have or don't have the condition we are testing for. Then we do a VQ scan on each of these 2,000 patients. In the group that we know has an embolus, if 900 are positive on the VQ scan, then we know that the surrogate test picks up the diagnosis 90% of the time. In the other 10%, for whatever reason, the surrogate test fails to demonstrate the emboli even though we know it's there. We now know that the false negative rate is 10%. This allows the clinician to forego the more difficult angiogram because they know how likely the VQ scan will be to pick up the embolus if it is there. They also know that in the event that the test is negative, they still have a 10% chance the test missed it. In that case, they may want to move to the angiogram if the level of suspicion is high that the patient does, in fact, have an embolus in spite of the negative VQ scan. This is basically the art of modern medicine. Likewise, the researchers can then take the 1,000 people who test negative on the angiogram, do a VQ scan on all of them, and determine the false positive rate. If 100 subjects test positive on the VQ scan even though you know for sure they have no clot, then you can accurately and confidently say that for whatever reason 10% of the time the VQ scan is saying you have a clot when you don't. Again, this helps the clinician who may be confronted with a patient whom he is pretty sure doesn't have a clot. For example, they may have evidence of pneumonia or a heart attack, but orders a VQ scan anyway. If the VQ scan is positive, they may want to confirm this by moving on to an angiogram because they know that in 10% of the cases the VQ scan is falsely positive. Clearly, the lower the number of false positives and false negatives, the better and more reliable is the test. The point is, without having a gold standard test with which to compare your surrogate test, and without this comparison having been performed in the clearest and most meticulous way possible, there is no possibility of having an accurate surrogate test. To be even clearer, without this comparison, the surrogate test is completely useless and misleading. Completely, yet officials are using surrogate COVID tests to send people into nursing homes, remove children from their families, and even separate newborn babies from their mothers if the mom tests positive. PCR tests, antibody tests, and every other test for a coronavirus are surrogate tests, which have never been compared to any gold standard. Therefore, they are completely and utterly useless and misleading. They are propaganda, not science. The gold standard test for a viral infection is the isolation, purification, and characterization of the virus as outlined in the description of Lanka's experiment and the proving of contagion. Lanka didn't prove that the virus he found was contagious simply because it isn't, and no virus is contagious. This is the only possible gold standard there can be. The PCR test examines the pieces of genetic material taken from a swab from the back of the sinus cavity, a very unpleasant procedure. No research has shown that this genetic material is unique to that of coronavirus or even that it comes from a coronavirus. Furthermore, in order to examine this genetic material, the test amplifies it. An amplification cycle means they start with a probe that matches the snippet of DNA or RNA they are looking for. Then, because this is too small to detect, they repeatedly double the snippets. If the sample changes the color of a solution, the test is considered positive. If you do too few amplification cycles, you never find the snippet, resulting in a false negative. If you do too many amplification cycles, you find the snippet too often because the test also amplifies the background genetic snippet's noise. These are false positives. One can therefore manipulate the amplification cycles to get whatever result one wants. Too few cycles and everyone tests negative, too many cycles and most test positive. John Magufuli, president of Tanzania, may be the wisest world ruler alive today. A chemist by training, Magufuli submitted samples to the World Health Organization for testing. Said Magufuli, "We took samples from goats, we sent samples from sheep's, we took samples from papas. We sent samples from car oil, and we took samples from other different things, and we took the samples to the laboratory without them knowing." His officials named the sample of car oil Jabal Hamza, 30 years old, male. The results came back negative. They named a sample of jackfruit Sarah Samuel, age 45, female. The results came back inconclusive. Papa got sent in as Elizabeth Ann, 26 years old, female. The poor pawpaw came back positive. Samples from a bird called quare and from a goat also tested positive. Rabbit was indeterminate, sheep was negative. President Magufuli is not wasting any government money on testing for his people, but in the West, governments have spent millions for the PCR test kits. Since no PCR test has ever undergone comparison to any gold standard, the results are meaningless. This is not a situation where we just need better or more accurate testing. As Carey Mullis, the inventor of the PCR technology, has insisted, time and again, PCR tests do not prove causation and cannot diagnose illness. The CDC and the FDA concede that the PCR test cannot be used for diagnosis. A file from March 30, 2020, stated, detection of viral RNA may not indicate the presence of infectious virus or that 2019 nCoV is the causative agent for clinical symptoms, and, this test cannot rule out diseases caused by other bacterial or viral pathogens. Furthermore, the FDA admits that, positive results, do not rule out bacterial infection or co-infection with other viruses. The agent detected may not be the definite cause of disease. According to a product announcement for the LightMix modular SARS assays, these assays are not intended for use as an aid in the diagnosis of coronavirus infection. One can only wonder what exactly the test is supposed to do if not diagnose a coronavirus infection. The same methodological problems are found with the new antibody tests for assessing immunity to coronavirus. Antibody testing is another type of surrogate testing that does not diagnose illness or ascertain its cause. A brilliant paper by David Crowe explains in detail the fact that the theoretical underpinnings of antibody testing have not been demonstrated in any experiment. This is why the Wake Forest immunologist had to admit, "We don't know enough about immunology to make any conclusions." Scientists believe that antibodies have a predictable and exact course as they track a viral infection. Antibodies are proteins made by our immune system to either fight off an illness or, remember, that we have encountered an infectious organism like a virus, at least, this is what we've been told. The theory is that before we encounter a virus or get sick from a virus, we have no antibodies to it. After getting sick, the PCR test should detect the virus, or, more accurately, the genetic pieces we think could have come only from that virus. Then after 1 week, because viruses and our immune system seem to understand the concept of 1 week, we begin to make an antibody called IgM, which is not specific to this coronavirus but is made by our immune system to fight off any virus. Then on day 14, as the virus is cleared from your body, the PCR test goes back to negative, the IgM levels go down, and we see the appearance of the more targeted IgG antibody. Then at day 21, because viruses understand that this happens in weekly intervals, the IgM is gone, the antibody test is reliably negative, and the IgG has peaked. At day 28, because your immune system also understands weeks, the IgG level drops to a level it can sustain for the long term. Once the test manufacturer or virologist sees a stable IgG level, they supposedly know you are immune for life from the effects of the virus. Or maybe not. This theoretical and imaginary construct has many holes big enough that you could drive a truck through them. Consider the following. It turns out that a small percentage actually have IgM, IgG, or both antibodies months before having the infection. How this is possible, since this is a novel virus that humans have never seen before, is not explained. Finally, studies show that IgG sometimes appears before and sometimes appears after IgM. Sometimes there is no IgM. Sometimes there is no IgG. In either case, it may mean you either had the virus or you didn't. And as with AIDS, there is no proof that a particular level of IgG confers immunity. But virologists have an explanation for this. These new wily viruses somehow know how to escape detection and neutralization even if the person has a robust antibody response. That, of course, is nonsense. Then we're told that a positive PCR test means you are either sick or not sick, infectious or not infectious, and that sometimes the test is positive, then negative, then positive, then negative. It's enough to make even the Mad Hatter go silent with disbelief.